and it will eat into the old debt rent like acid. Revenge really is best when eaten cold. He has the elevator to himself going down. The lobby is similarly empty. He walks around the corner, turning up the collar of Babineau's expensive overcoat against the wind, and tweets the locks of Babineau's Beamer. He gets in and starts it up, but only for the heater. Something needs doing before he moves on to his next destination. He doesn't really want to do it, because whatever his failings as a human being, Babineau has a gorgeously intelligent mind, and a great deal of it is still intact. Destroying that mind is too much like those dumb and superstitious ISIS fucks hammering irreplaceable treasures of art and culture to rubble. Yet it must be done. No risks can be allowed, because the body is also a treasure. Yes, Babineau has slightly high blood pressure, and his hearing has gone downhill in the last few years, but tennis and twice-weekly trips to the hospital gym have kept his muscles in fairly good shape. His heart ticks along at 70 beats a minute, with no misses. He is not suffering from sciatica, gout, cataracts, or any of the other outrages that affect many men at his age. Besides, the good doctor is what he's got, at least for now. With that in mind, Brady turns inward and finds what remains of Felix Babineau's core consciousness, the brain within the brain. It has been scarred and ravaged and diminished by Brady's repeated occupancies, but it is still there, still Babineau, still capable, theoretically at least, of taking back control. It is, however, defenseless, like some armored creature stripped of its shell. It's not exactly flesh. Babineau's core self is more like densely packed wires made of light. Not without regret, Brady seizes them with his phantom hand and tears them apart. 7. Hodges spends the evening slowly eating his yogurt and watching the Weather Channel. The winter storm, ridiculously dubbed Eugenie by the Weather Channel wonks, is still coming and is expected to hit the city sometime late tomorrow. Hard to be more exact as of now, the balding bespectacled wonk says to the knockout blonde wonk in the red dress. This one gives new meaning to the term stop-and-go traffic. The knockout wonk laughs as if her partner in meteorology has said something outrageously witty, and Hodges uses the remote to turn them off. The zapper, he thinks, looking at it. That's what everyone calls these things. Quite the invention when you stop to think of it. You can access hundreds of different channels by remote control. Never even have to get up. As if you're inside the television instead of in your chair, or in both places at the same time. Sort of a miracle, really. As he goes into the bathroom to brush his teeth, his cell phone buzzes. He looks at the screen and has to laugh, even though it hurts to do it. Now that he's in the privacy of his own home, with nobody to be bothered by the home run text alert, his old partner calls instead. Hey, Pete, nice to know you still remember my number. Pete has no time for banter. I'm going to tell you something, Kermit, and if you decide to run with it, I'm like Sergeant Schultz on Hogan's Heroes. Remember him? Sure. What Hodges feels in his gut right now isn't a pain cramp, but one of excitement. Weird how similar they are. I know nothing. Right. It has to be that way, because as far as this department is concerned, the murder of Martine Stover and the suicide of her mother is officially a closed case. We are certainly not going to reopen it because of a coincidence. And that's right from the top. Are we clear on that? As glass, Hodges says, what's the coincidence? The head nurse in the kind of brain injury clinic committed suicide last night, Ruth Scapelli. I heard, Hodges says. While on one of your pilgrimages to visit the delightful Mr. Hartsfield, I presume? Yeah. No need to tell Pete that he never got in to see the delightful Mr. Hartsfield. Scapelli had one of those game gadgets. A zap-it. She apparently threw it in the trash before she bled out. One of the forensics guys found it. Huh. Hodges goes back into the living room and sits down, wincing when his body folds in the middle. And that's your idea of a coincidence?
Not necessarily mine, Pete says heavily.
But I just want to retire in peace, goddammit. If there's a ball to carry on this one, Izzy can carry it. But Izzy don't want to carry no stinking ball.
No, neither does the captain or the commish.
Hearing this, Hodges is forced to slightly revise his opinion of his old partner as a burnt-out case. You actually spoke to them? Tried to keep this thing alive?
To the captain. Over Izzy Jane's objections, may I add. Her strident objections. The captain talked to the commish. Late this evening I got the word to drop it, and you know why.
Yeah, because it connects to Brady two ways. Martine Stover was one of his city center victims. Ruth Scapelli was his nurse. It would take a moderately bright reporter about 6 minutes to put those things together and stir up a nice fat scare story. That's what you got from Captain Peterson?
That's what I got. No one in police administration wants the spotlight back on Hartsfield, not when he's still judged incompetent to assist in his own defense and thus unable to stand trial. Hell, no one in city government wants it.
Hodges is silent, thinking hard. Maybe as hard as ever in his life. He learned the phrase to cross the Rubicon way back in high school and grasped its meaning without Mrs. Bradley's explanation. To make an irrevocable decision. What he learned later, sometimes to his sorrow, is that one comes upon most Rubicons unprepared. If he tells Pete that Barbara Robinson also had a zap it, and may also have had suicide on her mind when she left school and went to Lowtown, Pete will almost have to go back to Peterson. Two zap it-related suicides can be written off as coincidence, but three? And okay, Barbara didn't actually succeed, thank God, but she's another person with a connection to Brady. She was at the Round Here concert, after all, along with Hilda Carver and Dinah Scott, who also received zappets. But are the police capable of believing what he's starting to believe? It's an important question, because Hodges loves Barbara Robinson and does not want to see her privacy violated without some concrete result to show for it.
Kermit, are you there?
Yeah. Just thinking. Did the Scapelli woman have any visitors last night?
Can't tell you, because the neighbors haven't been interviewed. It was a suicide, not a murder.
Olivia Trelawney also committed suicide, Hodges says. Remember? It's Pete's turn to be silent. Of course he remembers. And he also remembers it was an assisted suicide. Hartsfield planted a nasty malware worm in her computer, made her think she was being haunted by the ghost of a young mother killed at city center. It helped that most people in the city had come to believe Olivia Trelawney's carelessness with her ignition key was partially responsible for the massacre. Brady always enjoyed.
I know what he always enjoyed, Pete says. No need to belabor the point. I've got one other scrap for you, if you want it.
Hit me.
I spoke to Nancy Alderson around 5 this afternoon.
Good for you, Pete, Hodges thinks. Doing a little more than punching the clock in your last few weeks.
She said that Mrs. Ellerton already bought her daughter a new computer for her online class. Said it's under the basement stairs, still in the carton. Ellerton was going to give it to Martine for her birthday next month.
Planning for the future, in other words. Not the act of a suicidal woman, is it?
No, I wouldn't say so. I have to go, Kerm. The ball is in your court. Play it or let it lie. Up to you.
Thanks, Pete. I appreciate the heads up.
I wish it was like the old days, Pete says. We would have gone after this thing and let the chips fall.
But it's not. Hodges is rubbing his side again.
No, it's not. You take care of yourself. Put on some goddamn weight.
I'll give it my best shot, Hodges says, but he's talking to no one. Pete is gone. He brushes his teeth, takes a painkiller, and climbs slowly into his pajamas. Then he goes to bed and stares up into the darkness, waiting for sleep or morning, whichever comes first.
8. Brady was careful to take Babineau's ID badge from the top of his bureau after donning Babineau's clothes, because the magnetic strip on the back turns it into an all-access pass. At 10:30 that night, around the time Hodges is finally getting a bellyful of the Weather Channel, he uses it for the first time to enter the gated employees' parking lot behind the main hospital building. The lot is loaded in the daytime, but at this hour, he has his pick of spaces. He chooses one as far from the pervasive glare of the arc sodiums as he can get. He tilts back the seat of Dr. B's luxury ride and kills the engine. He drifts into sleep and finds himself cruising through a light fog of disconnected memories, all that remains of Felix Babineau. He tastes the peppermint lipstick of the first girl he ever kissed, Marjorie Patterson, at East Junior High in Joplin, Missouri. He sees a basketball with the word Voight printed on it in fading black letters. He feels warmth in his training pants as he pees himself while coloring behind his gammer's sofa, a huge dinosaur covered in faded green velour. Childhood memories are apparently the last things to go. Shortly after 2 a.m., he flinches from a brilliant recollection of his father slapping him for playing with matches in the attic of their house and starts awake with a gasp in the Beamer's bucket seat. For a moment, the clearest detail of that memory lingers, a vein pulsing in his father's flushed neck just above the collar of his blue Izod golf shirt. And then he's Brady again, wearing a Babineau skin suit. 9. While mostly confined to room 217 and to a body that no longer works, Brady has had months to plan, to revise those plans and revise the revisions. He has made mistakes along the way. He wishes he'd never used Z-Boy to send Hodges a message using the Blue Umbrella site, for instance, and he should have waited before going after Barbara Robinson. Yet he has persevered, and here he is, on the verge of success. He has mentally rehearsed this part of the operation dozens of times, and now moves ahead confidently. A swipe of Babineau's card gets him in the door marked Maintenance A. On the floors above, the machines that run the hospital are heard as a muted hum, if they are heard at all. Down here, they're a steady thunder, and the tile hallway is stiflingly hot. But it's deserted, as he expected. A city hospital never falls into a deep sleep, but in the early hours of the morning, it shuts its eyes and dozes. The maintenance crew's break room is also deserted, as is the shower and changing area beyond it. Padlocks secure some of the lockers, but the majority of them are open. He tries one after the other, checking sizes, until he finds a gray shirt and a pair of work pants that are Babineau's approximate size. He takes off Babineau's clothes and puts on the maintenance worker's stuff, not neglecting to transfer the bottle of pills he took from Babineau's bathroom. It's a potent his-and-hers mixture. On one of the hooks by the showers, he sees the final touch, a red-and-blue groundhog's baseball cap. He takes it, adjusts the plastic band in back, and pulls it low over his forehead, making sure to get all of Babineau's silver hair covered up. He walks the length of Maintenance A and turns right into the hospital laundry, which is humid as well as hot. Two housekeepers are sitting in plastic contour chairs between two rows of gigantic Fashan dryers. Both are fast asleep, one with an overturned box of animal crackers spilling into the lap of her green nylon skirt. Farther down, past the washing machines, two laundry carts are parked against the cinder block wall. One is filled with hospital johnnies, the other piled high with fresh bed linens. Brady takes a handful of johnnies, puts them on top of the neatly folded sheets, and rolls the cart on down the hall. It takes a change of elevators and a walk across the skyway to reach the bucket, and he sees exactly four people on the journey. Two are nurses whispering together outside a med supply closet. Two are interns in the doctor's lounge, laughing quietly over something on a laptop computer. None of them notice the graveyard shift maintenance man, head down as he pushes an overloaded cart of laundry. The point where he's most apt to be noticed, and perhaps recognized, is the nurse's station in the middle of the bucket. But one of the nurses is playing solitaire on her computer, and the other is writing notes, propping her head up with her free hand. That one catches movement out of the corner of her eye, and without raising her head, asks how he's doing.
Yeah, good, Brady says. Cold night, though.
Uh-huh, and I heard there's snow coming. She yawns and goes back to her notes. Brady rolls his basket down the hall, stopping just short of 217. One of the bucket's little secrets is that here the patient rooms have two doors, one marked and one unmarked. The unmarked ones open into the closets, making it possible to restock linens and other necessaries at night without disturbing the patient's rest or their disturbed minds. Brady grabs a few of the Johnnies, takes a quick look around to make sure he is still unobserved, and slips through this unmarked door. A moment later, he's looking down at himself. For years, he has fooled everyone into believing that Brady Hartsfield is what the staff calls, only among themselves, a gork, a ding, or a L-O-B-N-H. Lights are on, but nobody's home. Now, he really is one. He bends and strokes one lightly stubbled cheek, runs the pad of his thumb over one closed lid, feeling the raised curve of eyeball beneath, lifts one hand, turns it over, and lays it gently palm up on the coverlet. From the pocket of the borrowed gray trousers, he takes the bottle of pills and spills half a dozen in the upturned palm. Take, eat, he thinks. This is my body, broken for you. He enters that broken body one final time. He doesn't need to use the Zap-It to do this now, nor does he have to worry that Babineau will seize control and run away like the gingerbread man. With Brady's mind gone, Babineau is the gork. Nothing left in there but a memory of his father's golf shirt. Brady looks around the inside of his head like a man giving a hotel room one last check after a long-term stay. Anything hanging, forgotten in the closet? A tube of toothpaste left in the bathroom? Maybe a cufflink under the bed? No. Everything is packed, and the room is empty. He closes his hand, hating the draggy way the fingers move, as if the joints are filled with sludge. He opens his mouth, lifts the pills, and drops them in. He chews. The taste is bitter. Babineau, meanwhile, has collapsed bonelessly to the floor. Brady swallows once. And again. There. It's done. He closes his eyes, and when he opens them again, he's staring beneath the bed at a pair of slippers Brady Hartsfield will never wear again. He gets to Babineau's feet, brushes himself off, and takes one more look at the body that carried him around for almost 30 years. The one that stopped being of any use to him the second time he was smashed in the head at Mingo Auditorium, just before he could trigger the plastic explosive strapped to the underside of his wheelchair. Once, he might have worried that this drastic step would backfire on him, that his consciousness and all his grand plans would die along with his body. No more. The umbilical cord has been severed. He has crossed the Rubicon. So long, Brady, he thinks. It was good to know you. This time, when he pushes the laundry cart past the nurse's station, the one who was playing solitaire is gone, probably to the bathroom. The other is asleep on her notes. 10. But it's 4:15 now, and there's so much more to do. After changing back into Babineau's clothes, Brady leaves the hospital the same way he entered and drives toward Sugar Heights. Because Z-Boy's homemade silencer is kaput, and an unmuffled gunshot is likely to be reported in the town's ritziest neighborhood, where rent-a-cops from Vigilant Guard Service are never more than a block or two away, he stops at Valley Plaza, which is on the way. He checks the empty lot for cop cars, sees none, and drives around to the loading area of Discount Home Furnishings.
God, it's so good to be out. Fucking wonderful.
Walking to the front of the Beamer, he breathes deeply of the cold winter air, wrapping the sleeve of Babineau's expensive topcoat around the 32's short barrel as he goes. It won't be as good as Z-Boy's silencer, and he knows it's a risk, but not a big one. Just the one shot. He looks up first, wanting to see the stars, but clouds have blanked out the sky. Oh well, there will be other nights. Many of them. Possibly thousands. He is not limited to Babineau's body, after all. He aims and fires. A small round hole appears in the Beamer's windshield. Now comes another risk, driving the last mile to Sugar Heights with a bullet hole in the glass just above the steering wheel. But this is the time of night when the suburban streets are at their emptiest and the cops also doze, especially in the better neighborhoods. Twice headlights approach him and he holds his breath, but both times they pass by without slowing. January air comes in through the bullet hole, making a thin, wheezing sound. He makes it back to Babineau's McMansion without incident. No need to tap the code this time. He just hits the gate opener clipped to the visor. When he reaches the top of the drive, he veers onto the snow-covered lawn, bounces over a hard crust of plowed snow, clips a bush, and stops. Home again, jiggity-jog. Only problem is, he neglected to bring a knife. He could get one in the house. He has another piece of business in there, but he doesn't want to make two trips. He has miles to go before he sleeps, and he's anxious to start rolling them. He opens the center console and paws through it. Surely a dandy like Babineau will keep spare grooming implements. Even a fingernail clipper will do. But there's nothing. He tries the glove compartment, and in the folder containing the Beamer's documents, leather, of course, he finds an Allstate insurance card laminated in plastic. It will serve. They are, after all, the good hands people. Brady pushes back the sleeve of Babineau's cashmere overcoat and the shirt beneath, then drags a corner of the laminated card over his forearm. It produces nothing but a thin red line. He goes again, bearing down much harder, lips pulled back in a grimace. This time, the skin splits and blood flows. He gets out of the car, holding his arm up, then leans back in. He tips a spatter of droplets, first onto the seat, and then onto the bottom arc of the steering wheel. There's not much, but it won't take much, not when combined with the bullet hole in the windshield. He bounds up the porch steps, each springy leap a small orgasm. Cora is lying beneath the hall coat hooks, just as dead as ever. Library Al is still asleep on the couch. Brady shakes him, and when he only gets a few muffled grunts, he grabs Al with both hands and rolls him onto the floor. Al's eyes creak open. Huh? What? The stare is dazed, but not completely blank. There's probably no Al Brooks left inside that plundered head, but there's still a bit of the alter ego Brady has created. Enough. Hey there, Z-Boy. Brady says, squatting down.
Hey, Z-Boy croaks, struggling to sit up. Hey there, Dr. Z. I'm watching that house just like you told me. The woman, the one who can still walk, she uses that Zap-It all the time. I watch her from the garage across the street.
You don't have to do that anymore.
No? Say, where are we?
My house, Brady says. You killed my wife. Z-Boy stares at the white-haired man in the overcoat, his mouth hung open. His breath is awful, but Brady doesn't draw away. Slowly, Z-Boy's face begins to crumple. It's like watching a car crash in slow motion.
Kill? Did not?
Yes.
No, never would.
You did, though, but only because I told you to.
Are you sure? I don't remember.
Brady takes him by the shoulder. It wasn't your fault. You were hypnotized. Z-Boy's face brightens.
By fishing hole.
Yes, by fishing hole. And while you were, I told you to kill Mrs. Babineau. Z-Boy looks at him with doubt and woe.
If I did, It wasn't my fault. I was hypnotized and can't even remember.
Take this. Brady hands Z-Boy the gun. Z-Boy holds it up, frowning, as if at some exotic artifact. Put it in your pocket and give me your car keys. Z-Boy stuffs the .32 absently into his pants pocket, and Brady winces, expecting the gun to go off and put a bullet in the poor sap's leg. At last, Z-Boy holds out his key ring. Brady pockets it, stands up, and crosses the living room.
Where are you going, Dr. Z?
I won't be long. Why don't you sit on the couch until I get back?
I'll sit on the couch until you get back,
Z-Boy says. Good idea. Brady goes into Dr. Babineau's study. There's an ego wall crammed with framed photos, including one of a younger Felix Babineau shaking hands with the second President Bush, both of them grinning like idiots. Brady ignores the pictures. He's seen them many times before, during the months when he was learning how to be in another person's body, what he now thinks of as his student driver days. Nor is he interested in the desktop computer. What he wants is the MacBook Air sitting on the credenza. He opens it, powers it up, and types in Babineau's password, which happens to be Sarah Bellin. Your drug didn't do shit, Brady says as the main screen comes up. He's actually not sure of this, but it's what he chooses to believe. His fingers rattle the keyboard with a practiced speed of which Babineau would have been incapable, and a hidden program, one Brady installed himself on a previous visit to the good doctor's head, pops up. It's labeled Fishin' Hole. He types again, and the program reaches out to the repeater in Freddie Linklater's computer hideaway. Working, the laptop screen says. And below this, 3 found.
3 found. 3 already.
Brady is delighted, but not really surprised, even though it's the graveyard of the morning. There are a few insomniacs in every crowd, and that includes the crowd that has received free Zap-Its from badconcert.com. What better way to while away the sleepless hours before dawn than with a handy game console? And before playing solitaire or Angry Birds, why not check those pink fish on the fishing hole demo screen and see if they've finally been programmed to turn into numbers when tapped? A combination of the right ones will win prizes, but at 4 in the morning, that may not be the prime motivator. 4 in the morning is usually an unhappy time to be awake. It's when unpleasant thoughts and pessimistic ideas come to the fore. And the demo screen is soothing. It's also addictive. Al Brooks knew that before he became Z-Boy. Brady knew from the moment he saw it. Just a lucky coincidence. But what Brady has done since, what he has prepared, is no coincidence. It's the result of long and careful planning in the prison of his hospital room and his wasted body. He shuts down the laptop, tucks it under his arm, and starts to leave the study. At the doorway, he has an idea and goes back to Babineau's desk. He opens the center drawer and finds exactly what he wants. He doesn't even have to rummage. When your luck is running, it's running. Brady returns to the living room. Z-Boy is sitting on the sofa, head lowered, shoulders slumped, hands dangling between his thighs. He looks unutterably weary. I have to go now. Brady says.
Where?
Not your business.
Not my business.
Exactly right. You should go back to sleep.
Here on the couch?
Or in one of the bedrooms upstairs. But you need to do something first. He hands Z-Boy the felt-tipped pin he found in Babineau's desk. Make your mark, Z-Boy. Just like when you were in Mrs. Ellerton's house.
They were alive when I was watching from the garage. I know that much, but they might be dead now.
They probably are, yes.
I didn't kill them too, did I? Because it seems like I was in the bathroom, at least, and drawed a Z there.
No, no, nothing like that.
I looked for the Zap-It, like you asked me to, I'm sure of that. I looked hard, but I didn't find it anywhere. I think maybe she throwed it away.
That doesn't matter anymore.
Just make your mark here, okay? Make it in at least 10 places, a thought occurs. Can you still count to 10?
1, 2, 3.
Brady glances at Babineau's Rolex. 4:15. Morning rounds in the bucket begin at 5. Time is fleeting on winged feet.
That's great. Make your mark in at least 10 places.
Then you can go back to sleep.
Okay. I'll make my mark in at least 10 places. Then I'll sleep. Then I'll drive over to that house you want me to watch. Or should I stop doing that now that they're dead?
I think you can stop now. Let's review, okay? Who killed my wife?
I did. But it wasn't my fault. I was hypnotized, and I can't even remember.
Z-Boy begins to cry.
Will you come back, Dr. Z?
Brady smiles, exposing Babineau's expensive dental work. Sure. His eyes move up and to the left as he says it. He watches the old guy shuffle to the huge God I'm Rich television mounted on the wall and draw a large Z on the screen. Z's all over the murder scene aren't absolutely necessary, but Brady thinks it will be a nice touch, especially when the police ask the former library owl for his name and he tells them it's Z-Boy. Just a bit of extra filigree on a finely crafted piece of jewelry. Brady goes to the front door, stepping over Cora again on the way. He bops down the porch steps and does a dance move at the bottom, snapping Babineau's fingers. That hurts a little. Just a touch of incipient arthritis, but so what? Brady knows what real pain is, and a few twinges in the old phalanges ain't it. He jogs to Al's Malibu. Not much of a ride compared to the late Dr. Babineau's BMW, but it will get him where he needs to go. He starts it and frowns when classical shit comes pouring out of the dashboard speaker. He switches to BAM 100 and finds some Black Sabbath from back when Ozzy was still cool. He takes a final look at the Beamer parked askew on the lawn, then gets rolling. Miles to go before he sleeps. And then the final touch, the cherry on top of the sundae. He won't need Freddy Linklater for that, only Dr. B's MacBook. He's running without a leash now. He's free. 11. Around the time Z-Boy is proving that he can still count to 10, Freddy Linklater's blood-caked lashes come unstuck from her blood-caked cheeks. She finds herself looking into a gaping brown eye. It takes her several long moments to decide it isn't really an eye, only a swirl of wood grain that looks like an eye. She is lying on the floor and suffering the worst hangover of her life, even worse than after that cataclysmic party to celebrate her 21st when she mixed crystal meth with Ronrico. She thought later that she was lucky to have survived that little experiment. Now, she almost wishes she hadn't, because this is worse. It's not only her head. Her chest feels like Marshawn Lynch has been using her for a tackling dummy. She tells her hands to move, and they reluctantly answer the call. She places them in push-up position and shoves. She comes up, but her top shirt stays down, stuck to the floor in a pool of what looks like blood and smells suspiciously like scotch. So that's what she was drinking and fell over her own stupid feet. Smacked her head. But dear God, how much did she put away? It wasn't like that, she thinks. Someone came, and you know who it was. It's a simple process of deduction. Lately, she's only had 2 visitors here, the Z dudes. And the one who wears the ratty parka hasn't been around for a while. She tries to get to her feet and can't make it at first, nor can she take more than shallow breaths. Deeper ones hurt her above her left breast. It feels like something is sticking in there. My flask? I was spinning it while I waited for him to show up, to give me the final payment and get out of my life. Shot me. She croaks. Fucking Dr. Z shot me.
She staggers into the bathroom and is hardly able to believe the train wreck she sees in the mirror. The left side of her face is covered with blood, and there's a purple knob rising from a gash above her left temple, but that's not the worst. Her blue chambray shirt is also matted with blood, mostly from the head wound, she hopes. Head wounds bleed like crazy, and there's a round black hole in the left breast pocket. He shot her, all right. Now she remembers the bang and the smell of gun smoke just before she passed out. She tweezes her shaking fingers into the breast pocket, still taking those shallow breaths, and pulls out her pack of Marlboro lights. There's the bullet hole right through the middle of the M. She drops the cigarettes into the basin, works at the buttons of the shirt, and lets it fall to the floor. The smell of scotch is stronger now. The shirt beneath is khaki, with big flap pockets. When she tries to pull the flask from the one on the left, she utters a low mewl of agony, all she can manage without taking a deeper breath. But when she gets it free, the pain in her chest lessens a little. The bullet also went through the flask, and the prongs on the side closest to her skin are bright with blood. She drops the ruined flask on top of the Marlboros and goes to work on the khaki shirt's buttons. This takes longer, but eventually it also falls to the floor. Beneath it is an American Giant tee, the kind that also has a pocket. She reaches into it and takes out a tin of Altoids. There's a hole in this, too. The tee has no buttons, so she works her pinky finger into the bullet hole in the pocket and pulls. The shirt tears, and at last, she's looking at her own skin, freckled with blood. There's a hole just where the scant swell of her breast begins, and in it, she can see a black thing. It looks like a dead bug. She tears the rip in the shirt wider, using three fingers now, then reaches in and grasps the bug. She wiggles it like a loose tooth. Ooh. Ooh. Ooh, fuck. It comes free. Not a bug, but a slug. She looks at it, then drops it into the sink with the other stuff. In spite of her aching head and the throbbing in her chest, Freddy realizes how absurdly fortunate she has been. It was just a little gun, but at such close range, even a little gun should have done the job. It would have, too, if not for a 1 in 1,000 lucky break. First through the cigarettes, then through the flask, which had been the real stopper, then through the Altoids tin, then into her. How close to her heart? An inch? Less? Her stomach clenches, wanting to puke. She won't let it. Can't let it. The hole in her chest will start bleeding again, but that's not the main thing. Her head will explode. That's the main thing. Her breathing is a little easier now that she's removed the flask with its nasty but life-saving prongs of metal. She plods back into her living room and stares at the puddle of blood and scotch on the floor. If he had bent over and put the muzzle of the gun to the back of her neck, just to make sure. Freddy closes her eyes and fights to retain consciousness as waves of faintness and nausea float through her. When it's a little better, she goes to her chair and sits down very slowly, like an old lady with a bad back, she thinks. She stares at the ceiling. What now? Her first thought is to call 911, get an ambulance over here and go to the hospital, but what will she tell them? That a man claiming to be a Mormon or Jehovah's Witness knocked on her door and when she opened it, he shot her? Shot her why? For what? And why would she, a woman living alone, open her door to a stranger at 10:30 in the evening? That isn't all. The police will come. In her bedroom is an ounce of pot and an 8-ball of coke. She could get rid of that shit, but what about the shit in her computer room? She's got half a dozen illegal hacks going on, plus a ton of expensive equipment that she didn't exactly buy. The cops will want to know if just perchance, Ms. Linklater, the man who shot you had something to do with said electronic gear. Maybe you owed him money for it? Maybe you were working with him, stealing credit card numbers,
and other personal info? And they can hardly miss the repeater, blinking away like a Las Vegas slot machine as it sends out its endless signal via Wi-Fi, delivering a customized malware worm every time it finds a live Zap-It.
What's this, Ms. Linkletter? What exactly does it do?
And what will she tell them? She looks around, hoping to see the envelope of cash lying on the floor of the couch, but of course he took it with him. If there was ever cash in there at all, and not just cut-up strips of newspaper. She's here. She's shot. She's had a concussion. Please God, not a fracture. And she's low on dough. What to do? Turn off the repeater. That's the first thing. Dr. Z has got Brady Hartsfield inside him, and Brady is a bad motorcycle. Whatever the repeater's doing is nasty shit. She was going to turn it off anyway, wasn't she? It's all a little vague, but wasn't that the plan? To turn it off and exit stage left? She doesn't have that final payment to help finance her flight, but despite her loose habits with cash, there's still a few thousand in the bank, and Corn Trust opens at 9. Plus, there's her ATM card. So, turn off the repeater, nip that creepy Z the end sight in the bud, wash the gore off her face, and get the fuck out of Dodge. Not by plane. These days airport security areas are like baited traps, but by any bus or train headed into the Golden West. Isn't that the best idea? She's up and shuffling toward the door of the computer room when the obvious reason why it is not the best idea hits her. Brady is gone, but he wouldn't leave if he couldn't monitor his projects from a distance, especially the repeater, and doing that is the easiest thing in the world. He's smart about computers. Brilliant, actually, although it pisses her off to admit it. And he's almost certainly left himself a back door into her setup. If so, he can check in any time he wants. All it will take is a laptop. If she shuts his shit down, he'll know. And he'll know she's still alive. He'll come back. So what do I do? Freddy whispers. She trudges to her window, shivering. It's so fucking cold in this apartment once winter comes, and looks out into the dark. What do I do now?
12. Hodges is dreaming of Bowser, the feisty little mongrel he had when he was a kid. His father hauled Bowser to the vet and had him put down, over Hodges' weeping protests after old Bows bit the newspaper boy badly enough to require stitches. In this dream, Bowser is biting him in the side. He won't let go even when young Billy Hodges offers him the best treat in the treat bag, and the pain is excruciating. The doorbell is ringing, and he thinks, "That's the paper boy. Go bite him. You're supposed to bite him." Only, as he swims up from this dream and back into the real world, he realizes it isn't the doorbell. It's the phone by his bed. The landline. He gropes for it, drops it, picks it up off the duvet, and manages a furry approximation of hello.
"Figured you'd have your cell on Do Not Disturb,"
Pete Huntley says. He sounds wide awake and weirdly jovial. Hodges squints at the bedside clock but can't read it. His bottle of painkillers, already half empty, is blocking the digital readout. Jesus, how many did he take yesterday? "I don't know how to do that either." Hodges struggles to a sitting position. He can't believe the pain has gotten so bad so fast. It's as if it was just waiting to be identified before pouncing with all its claws out.
"You need to get a life, Kerm."
A little late for that, he thinks, swinging his legs out of bed. "Why are you calling at..." He moves the bottle of pills. "At 6:40 in the morning?"
"Couldn't wait to give you the good news," Pete says. "Brady Hartsfield is dead. A nurse discovered him on morning rounds."
Hodges shoots to his feet, producing a stab of pain he hardly feels. "What? How?"
"There'll be an autopsy later today, but the doctor who examined him is leaning towards suicide. There's a residue of something on his tongue and gums. The doc on call took a sample, and a guy from the ME's office is taking another as we speak. They're going to rush the analysis, Hartsfield being such a rock star and all."
"Suicide," Hodges says, running a hand through his already crazed hair. The news is simple enough, but he still can't seem to take it in. Suicide?
He was always a fan, Pete says. I believe you might have said that yourself and more than once.
Yeah, but... But what? Pete's right. Brady was a fan of suicide, and not just the other guys. He had been ready to die at the City Center job fair in 2009 if things worked out that way, and a year later he rolled a wheelchair into Mingo Auditorium with 3 pounds of plastic explosives strapped to the seat, which put his ass at ground zero. Only that was then, and things have changed, haven't they?
But what?
I don't know, Hodges says.
I do. He finally found a way to do it. Simple as that. In any case, if you thought Hartsfield was somehow involved in the deaths of Ellerton, Stover, and Scapelli, and I have to tell you I had my own thoughts along that line, you can stop worrying. He's a gone goose, a toasty turkey, a baked buzzard, and we all say hooray.
Pete, I need to process this a little.
No doubt, Pete says. You had quite the history with him. Meanwhile, I have to call Izzy, get her day started on the good foot.
Will you call me when you get back the analysis of whatever he swallowed?
Indeed I will. Meanwhile, sayonara, Mr. Mercedes, right?
Right, right. Hodges hangs up the phone, walks into the kitchen, puts on a pot of coffee. He should have tea. Coffee will burn the shit out of his poor struggling innards, but right now he doesn't care. And he won't take any pills, not for a while. He needs to be as clear-headed about this as he possibly can. He snatches his mobile off the charger and calls Holly. She answers at once, and he wonders briefly what time she gets up. 5? Even earlier? Maybe some questions are best left unanswered. He tells her what Pete just told him, and for once in her life, Holly Gibney does not gild her profanity.
You've got to be fucking kidding me.
Not unless Pete was kidding, and I don't think he was. He doesn't try joking until mid-afternoon, and he's not very good at it then. Silence for a moment, and then Holly asks,
Do you believe it?
That he's dead, yes. It could hardly be a case of mistaken identity. That he committed suicide? To me, that seems... He fishes for the right phrase, can't find it, and repeats what he said to his old partner not 5 minutes before. I don't know.
Is it over?
Maybe not.
That's what I think, too. We have to find out what happened to the Zappets that were left over after the company went broke. I don't understand how Brady Hartsfield could have had anything to do with them, but so many of the connections go back to him and to the concert he tried to blow up.
I know. Hodges is again picturing a web with a big old spider at the center of it, one full of poison. Only the spider is dead. And we all say, hooray, he thinks. Holly, can you be at the hospital when the Robinsons come to pick up Barbara?
I can do that.
After a pause, she adds,
I'd like to do that. I'll call Tanya to make sure it's okay, but I'm sure it is. Why?
I want you to show Barb a six-pack. 5 elderly white guys in suits, plus Dr. Felix Babineau.
You think Myram Zacum was Hartsfield's doctor? That he was the one who gave Barbara and Hilda those Zappets.
At this point, it's just a hunch. But that's modest. It's actually a bit more. Babineau gave Hodges a cock-and-bull story to keep him out of Brady's room, then nearly blew a gasket when Hodges asked if he was all right. And Norma Wilmer claims he's been conducting unauthorized experiments on Brady. Investigate Babineau, she said in Bar-Bar Black Sheep. Get him in trouble. I dare you. As a man who probably only has months to live, that doesn't seem like much of a dare.
Okay. I respect your hunches, Bill. And I'm sure I can find a society page picture of Dr. Babineau from one of those charity events they're always having for the hospital.
Good. Now refresh me on the name of the bankruptcy trustee guy.
Todd Schneider. You should call him at 8:30. If I'm with the Robinsons, I won't be in until later. I'll bring Jerome with me.
Yeah, good. Have you got Schneider's number?
I emailed it to you. You remember how to access your email, don't you?
It's cancer, Holly, not Alzheimer's.
Today is your last day. Remember that, too.
How can he forget? They'll put him in the hospital where Brady died, and that will be that. Hodge's last case left hanging fire. He hates the idea, but there's no way around it. This is going fast.
Eat some breakfast.
I will. He ends the call and looks longingly at the fresh pot of coffee. The smell is wonderful. He turns it down the sink and gets dressed. He does not eat breakfast.
13. Finders Keepers seems very empty without Holly at her desk in the reception area, but at least the seventh floor of the Turner building is quiet. The noisy crew from the travel agency down the hall won't start to arrive for at least another hour. Hodges thinks best with a yellow pad in front of him, jotting down ideas as they come, trying to tease out the connections and form a coherent picture. It's the way he worked when he was on the cops, and he was capable of making those connections more often than not. He won a lot of citations over the years, but they're piled helter-skelter on a shelf in his closet instead of hanging on a wall. The citations never mattered to him. The reward was the flash of light that came with the connections. He found himself unable to give it up. Hence, Finders Keepers instead of retirement. This morning there are no notes, only doodles of stick men climbing a hill, and cyclones, and flying saucers. He's pretty sure most of the pieces to this puzzle are now on the table, and all he has to do is figure out how to put them together, but Brady Hartsfield's death is like a pile-up on his personal information highway, blocking all traffic. Every time he glances at his watch, another 5 minutes have gone by. Soon enough, he'll have to call Schneider. By the time he gets off the phone with him, the noisy travel agency crew will be arriving. After them, Barbara and Jerome. Any chance of quiet thought will be gone.
Think of the connections, Holly said. They all go back to him and the concert he tried to blow up.
Yes. Yes, they do. Because the only ones eligible to receive free Zappets from that website were people, young girls then, for the most part teenagers now, who could prove they were at the Round Here show. And the website is now defunct. Like Brady, badconcert.com is a gone goose, a toasty turkey, a baked buzzard, and we all say hooray. At last, he prints two words amid the doodles and circles them. One is concert, the other is residue. He calls Kiner Memorial and is transferred to the bucket. Yes, he's told Norma Wilmer is in, but she's busy and can't come to the phone. Hodges guesses she's very busy this morning and hopes her hangover isn't too bad. He leaves a message asking that she call him back as soon as she can and emphasizes that it's urgent. He continues doodling until 8:25. Now it's Zappets he's drawing, possibly because he's got Dinah Scott's in his coat pocket, then calls Todd Schneider, who answers the phone personally. Hodges identifies himself as a volunteer consumer advocate working with the Better Business Bureau, and says he's been tasked with investigating some Zappet consoles that have shown up in the city. He keeps his tone easy, almost casual. This is no big deal, especially since the Zappets were given away, but it seems that some of the recipients are downloading books from something called the Sunrise Reader's Circle, and they're coming through garbled.
Sunrise Reader's Circle?
Schneider sounds bemused. No sign he's getting ready to put up a shield of legalese, and that's the way Hodges wants to keep it.
As in Sunrise Solutions?
Well, yes, that's what prompted the call. According to my information, Sunrise Solutions bought out Zappet Inc. before going bankrupt.
Well, that's true. But I've got a ton of paperwork on Sunrise Solutions, and I don't recall anything about a Sunrise Reader's Circle. And it would have stood out like a sore thumb. Sunrise was basically involved in gobbling up small electronics companies, looking for that one big hit, which they never found, unfortunately.
What about the Zappet Club? Ring any bells?
Never heard of it.
Or a website called ztheend.com? As he asks this question, Hodges smacks himself in the forehead. He should have checked that site for himself instead of filling a page with dumb doodles.
Nope. Never heard of that either.
Now comes a tiny rattle of the legal shield.
Is this a consumer fraud issue?
because bankruptcy laws are very clear on the subject, and
nothing like that, Hodges soothes. Only reason we're even involved is because of the jumbled downloads, and at least one of the Zappets was dead on arrival. The recipient wants to send it back, maybe get a new one.
Not surprised someone got a dead console if it was from the last batch, Schneider says. There were a lot of defectives, maybe 30% of the final run.
As a matter of personal curiosity, how many were in that final run?
I'd have to look up the number, to be sure, but I think around 40,000 units. Zappet sued the manufacturer, even though suing Chinese companies is pretty much a fool's game. But by then they were desperate to stay afloat. I'm only giving you this information because the whole business is done and dusted.
Understood.
Well, the manufacturing company, Yiching Electronics, came back with all guns blazing. Probably not because of the money at stake, but because they were worried about their reputation. Can't blame them there, can you?
No. Hodges can't wait any longer for pain relief. He takes out his bottle of pills, shakes out two, then reluctantly puts one back. He puts it under his tongue to melt, hoping it will work faster that way. I guess you can't.
Yiching claimed the defective units were damaged in shipping, probably by water. They said if it had been a software problem, all the games would have been defective. Makes a degree of sense to me, but I'm no electronics genius. Anyway, Zappet went under, and Sunrise Solutions elected not to proceed with the suit. They had bigger problems by then. Creditors snapping at their heels. Investors jumping ship.
What happened to that final shipment?
Well, they were an asset, of course, but not a very valuable one due to the defect issue. I held on to them for a while, and we advertised in the trades to retail companies that specialize in discounted items. Chains like the Dollar Store and Economy Wizard, are you familiar with those?
Yeah. Hodges had bought a pair of factory second loafers at the local dollar store. They cost more than a buck, but they weren't bad. Wore well.
Of course, we had to make it clear that as many as 3 in every 10 Zappet commanders, that's what the last iteration was called, might be defective, which meant each one would have to be checked. That killed any chance for selling the whole shipment. Checking the units one by one would have been too labor-intensive.
Uh-huh.
So, as bankruptcy trustee, I decided to have them destroyed and claim a tax credit, which would have amounted to, well, quite a lot. Not by General Motors standards, but mid-six figures. Clear the books, you understand.
Right. Makes sense.
But before I could do that, I got a call from a fellow at a company called Games Unlimited, right there in your city. That's Games with a Z on the end. Called himself the CEO. Probably CEO of a three-man operation working out of two rooms or a garage.
Schneider chuckles a big business New York chuckle.
Since the computer revolution really got rolling, these outfits pop up like weeds, although I never heard of any of them actually giving product away. It smells a trifle scammy, don't you think?
Yeah, Hodges says. The dissolving pill is exceedingly bitter, but the relief is sweet. He thinks that's the case with a great many things in life. A Reader's Digest insight, but that doesn't make it invalid.
It does, actually.
The legal shield has gone bye-bye. Schneider is animated now, wrapped up in his own story.
The guy offered to buy 800 Zappets at $80 apiece, which was roughly $100 cheaper than the suggested retail. We dickered a bit and settled on 100.
Per unit?
Yes.
Comes to $80,000, Hodges says. He's thinking of Brady, who had been hit with God only knew how many civil suits for sums mounting into the tens of millions of dollars. Brady, who'd had, if Hodges' memory serves him right, about $1,100 in the bank. And you got a check for that amount? He's not sure he'll get an answer to the question. Many lawyers would close the discussion off at this point, but he does. Probably because the Sunrise Solutions bankruptcy is all tied up in a nice legal bow. For Schneider, this is like a post-game interview.
Correct. Drawn on the game's unlimited account.
Cleared okay?
Todd Schneider chuckles his big business chuckle. If it hadn't, those 800 Zappet consoles would have been recycled into new computer goodies along with the rest.
Hodges scribbles some quick math on his doodle-decorated pad. If 30% of the 800 units were defective, that leaves 560 working consoles. Or maybe not that many. Hilda Carver got one that had presumably been vetted. Why else give it to her? But according to Barbara, it had given a single blue flash.